We're back, and we're honored to have Mr. John Berendt, author of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, with us today to discuss his latest book, The City of Falling Angels. Good morning, Mr. Berendt.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you for joining us today.
Yes.
In your new book, The City of Falling Angels, you begin by telling the reader why, in part, you chose to write about Venice. You say, why Venice? Because, to my mind, Venice was uniquely beautiful, isolated, inward-looking, and powerful stimulant to the senses, the intellect, and the imagination.
Yes. Well, in fact, it's all those things. And I chose it because I had originally written Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which
right.
is set in Savannah, which was also all those things, also isolated. Now, each of those two cities is a self-contained cultural and emotional environment, which is a wonderful way to place a story because it makes it more vivid, and readers can escape into that into the book that way. But I chose Venice because it's unique, of course, and it's been often remarked that the whole city looks like a painted stage set. In fact, it does. And as you walk around, if you live in Venice, you walk around it every day. You have to walk. There are no cars, obviously. You begin to feel like a player on a stage. And the Venetians act out their own personal dramas and as they go through. I was talking to a Venetian count who said to me, all Venetians are acting. We all play roles. He said, as we go over a bridge, and there are 450 bridges in Venice, the bridges are not to us, they're not obstacles to get over. You have to climb
right.
up to get from one side of the canal to the other.
Right.
They are transitions
right.
in our lives. We go from one reality to another reality, from one role to another role. Our role changes as we go over bridges. Now, that might sound ridiculous, but that's the way he put it. And then he said to me, Venetians never tell the truth. We always mean the opposite of what we say.
It is marvelous. And you know, you do what travel writers all over the world love doing. You wander through the heart of the destination, almost as invisible or as a neutral observer, and yet you become very engaged in the story yourself. Can you tell us how this writing experience was unique or different for you?
Well, it was the same genre I had used before in Midnight.
Right.
It was unique because of the locale, but it is also unusual for a travel writer actually to get past that barrier between public and private. I mean, generally, a tourist experiences the public. In other words, the monuments, the buildings, the art, the restaurants, the hotel, the transportation, whatever, the views. What I was attempting to do is to go through that invisible door that takes you to the private Venice. I was interested in not just Venice, but in people who live in Venice full-time, which is to say Venetians and expatriates who have settled there. Because I realized that most of what we read about Venice really isn't about Venetians. The novel, for instance,
right.
Death in Venice, The Wings of the Dove,
right.
Don't Look Now, all of those are about people passing through. So the uniqueness of this particular book, City of Falling Angels, is really that it treats the people who live in Venice rather than Venice as a plain tourist attraction.
Right, exactly.
So what I was trying to attempt to do is to give a tourist a glimpse inside the palace walls and into the homes of Venetians. And this is, I think, what makes this a different kind of book, actually. It does, in many ways, inform the tourists about things that they want to know about, but also tells them what, you know, they probably won't be seeing firsthand.
Exactly. Now, you arrive in Venice 3 days, or 3 days prior to your arrival, the opera house, the La Fenice, burns down. Now, how did that fire have an impact on your book?
Well, since I was writing the story about the stories in Venice, it was by sheer coincidence that when I arrived in Venice, that the most important opera house in Italy had just burned down, and it had a very important role in the history of opera because five of Verdi's operas were commissioned by the Fenice and first performed there. But it was a a signal important event for Venice, because not only was this an architectural treasure, but it was the only remaining opera house in Venice. They once had had a dozen.
Right.
So there was, the last one there, and it was gone. And not only that, it was there was no major stage left for the performing arts of any kind, for ballet, for concerts, whatever.
Now, what was the short-term and the long-term effects of the fire on Venice itself?
Well, the short term was that they had to find out who did it, if it was an accident compounded by negligence or arson. They decided it was arson.
Right.
And then, of course, they had to have a trial and figure out, you know, what punishment to mete out. But at the same time, they had to go through the rebuilding of it, and they had decided to build it in the very, very form and shape that it had been before. It was going to be as it was, where it was. That's a motto that they came up with. They had used it in the beginning of the 20th century when the bell tower in St. Mark's collapsed. They built it as it was, where it was. They did the same thing with the Fenice. And that was the immediate response to and the immediate impact on the city. It was quite a tumultuous event because Venetians were heartsick about it, and they realized, the mayor said, we must rebuild the Fenice because we have to prove to ourselves and to the world that we are alive, a living city. Without any stage for the performing arts, they really weren't. Their culture was lacking a heartbeat. I mean, because it is the center of beautiful art and architecture,
right,
in question. But all of that was created more than 200 years ago. They didn't have anything of any currency without a stage, and now they do. They've rebuilt it. So the long-term effects of this are that they have restored an architectural treasure that tourists enjoy seeing, and they have once again given Venice a living, breathing stage for current cultural events.
And as you say in the book, it drove one of the famous glass blowers to the point of just dedicating himself to create works of art over this.
Based on the fire.
Exactly.
This was Archimedes Aguso, who watched the fire from his bedroom window 30 feet from the actual Fenice, across a canal from the Fenice, and he refused to leave the house. The firemen and the police begged him to leave, and his family begged him to leave, but he could tell by looking at the fire, since he had been looking at the fire at his furnace for 76 years, he knew that the fire was not going to come across in their direction. It was going to miss them if it did leap into other buildings. So the next morning, he got up at 5 o'clock as usual, and he went to his glass-blowing factory on the island of Murano, and he started making a series of bowls and vases based on the colors, the swirling colors that he saw in the fire the night before. And when various substances were burning inside the Fenice, they created greens and blues and purples and not just the regular flame colors.
How marvelous, huh?
Yeah, it was quite an astonishing feat of glass blowing.
Of
but
course,
it was his way. It was his, in fact, it was his testimony about the
right,
fire.
Of expressing it all. Yeah, how beautiful. The perennial question, always seems to be, is Venice sinking?
Well, the technical answer is no, it's not sinking anymore.
Right.
It had been sinking because the weight of cities does press a city down a little bit. But also, in the 20th century, for about 30 years, they were extracting water from under the Venice for drinking water, and they realized that they were sucking the city further into the lagoon. So they stopped that, and they pumped water back under it, and they regained an inch. However, what the real problem is the rising sea level.
Right.
Because Venice is built at sea level or slightly above, and whenever there's a very high tide, the lower parts of Venice become flooded, and St. Mark's Square is the lowest part of Venice, as it happens. It's the most famous part of Venice. These floods are happening more frequently. That's the big problem. And what is being done right now is that the whole system of dikes, movable dikes, is being built. This had been on the drawing boards for almost 30 years, and the Italians were arguing about it nonstop. But what it will do is this. Venice is in the middle of a lagoon which is separated from the Adriatic Sea by the Lido, which is a long barrier island. There are three openings to the sea in the Lido, and the water comes in at high tide and goes out at low tide, and thereby flushing the water in the lagoon, keeping it clear.
Right.
Well, when the high tides come, if the high tides are extremely high, dikes will rise up from the bottom of the lagoon on huge hinges and block the ocean or the sea for the duration of the high tide. That's what's going to be the solution, at least for the moderately short term, 30 years or so. And if anything more is needed after that, then they're going to have to, you know, deal with it. The technology is there, and it can be done. Venice is in danger of not destruction, but lots of damage when they have a particularly high tide, because all the first floor shops and restaurants have to replace their machinery, and, you know, the stove flooded with salt water is no good anymore. So there's that terrible problem, but as far as the city being wiped away, it's not going to happen.
Can you perhaps suggest to our listeners and readers how they too can go to the heart of Venice?
What you can do, now, Venice is not much bigger than Central Park, but there are four major nodes in Venice: St. Mark's Square, the Accademia Museum, the Rialto, and the train station. And most of the tourists go from one to the other, to the other, to the other. And that's where all the crush of tourists
right,
are, in
right.
those narrow streets.
Exactly.
So all you've got to do is take a right turn or a left turn and walk away.
Get away
and you'll
me.
Find yourself in a very quiet neighborhood. You'll find yourself in the typical Venetian space. Also, I would suggest that people, tourists, go to the... There are six neighborhoods, and they all each have... They're called sestieri. Go to the one on the far east and the far west. The far east is Castello, and that's a very, very Venetian neighborhood, not often visited by tourists. And Canareggio is on the western end, near the railroad station, and you can find many areas of quiet Venetian neighborhoods there. So you just walk away from the main tourist precincts, and you'll find yourself in the typical Venetian town.
Now, some say that there's often a very fine line between fiction and nonfiction. In your experience, is there a similar distinction that can be made between storytelling, travel writing, travel literature, and travel journalism?
There shouldn't be much difference, because it all should be nonfiction. I've written my two books in the form of novels. That isn't to say they're fiction.
Exactly.
But they're structured the way a novel is structured, from scene to scene. This action that carries through. A lot of nonfiction is just episodic. This happened, and that happened, and that happened, and that happened. But with literary nonfiction, you have far greater precise descriptions of people and places, and dialogue, extended dialogue, and you use the literary devices that novelists use. However, there's a lot being made about the line between fiction and nonfiction. And basically, if a book is nonfiction, then it's true. In my first book, At Midnight, I did switch around some of the events in time. It didn't affect the telling of the story.
Right.
It didn't change the facts, but I put a note in my book saying, this is nonfiction. However, I've taken storytelling liberties, mostly having to do with the sequence of events. And with a note like that, then you're explaining this is nonfiction. However, there have been some liberties taken. Now, there have been a case recently where James Fry didn't put such a note in and made up a lot of stuff. And that is more fiction than nonfiction.
Right. Now, at Talking Travel, we're committed to telling the stories with as much depth, substance, and clarity as we can. Do you have any advice for young travel writers about how to do this?
Well, it takes a lot of research. You have to meet people.
That's for sure.
A lot of research, and I think you have to meet people who either live there or who are officials in the place to get the stories. That's what will bring travel writing alive, is to go beyond the inanimate descriptions of buildings and arts and architecture, and get into the history, contemporary history or ancient history, and talk about people. People are interested in people, and mm-hmm. you can bring a place to life by putting stories that involve people who live there.
how masterfully and you've done that in both your books. And it's a wonderful book. I thank you for taking the time to share that with us. And the book will be up on our site for those that are listening. And once again, thank you very much, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, Mr. John Berendt, author of The City of Falling Angels, we're going to go to break. And when we come back, Mr. Bob Fisher will be filling in for Suzanne Wright, who is still up in Quebec. So hang in with us. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back.